This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. It is the Legal Hour with our good friend Kevin Flesch, and we always try to address a lot of different legal areas here. We talk a lot about the personal injury side of things, which we will do today, but a few other things popped up, and first of all, let me welcome Mr. Flesch.
Thank you very much, sir. Scott.
Good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Man, it's the smoke around, first of all. Lord, it is. Man, yesterday was very smoky.
Yes.
Fires everywhere. Canada, California, I've heard. I mean, everywhere.
Yeah, it's all over. And, you know, we're in this inversion, so it's just bumping up against the... It's an interesting weather scenario.
Right, right. Your kids are back in school.
And, they are. Yeah. It's very exciting. And I think all of the school districts now,
for the most part. Yeah.
So people, make sure that you're watchful of those school zones and all of the other things attendant relating to those kids going back, bus stops, everything else.
Sure, sure.
School zones are a big revenue generation for the city this time of year because people forget.
And I don't think you get out of those tickets.
No, you don't. And it's double the fine. It's always double the fine. So,
wow. You
know, you may be able to reduce the points, but definitely just slow down. Mm-hmm. It's best for everybody. And 20 miles per hour means 20 miles per hour. So,
It is the Legal Hour here with Kevin. And I tell you what, let's just start there because one note I had on here about school buses, I was behind one just the other day. And so I was behind. I saw a little sign pop out, said stop. But then I looked on the opposite side of the road, traffic going the other way, and everybody's just flying by.
Yeah.
And then I looked it up because I'm like, I really don't know. But everybody's supposed to stop.
Yes, both lanes of
both
traffic.
Lanes.
Yes, all lanes of traffic relating to buses when they open up that stop sign. It's a two-way stop sign for a reason, so that the people coming at the bus and the people behind the bus stop. And that's for the safety of the kids because they may have to go across the street.
Sure, and you know kids, when they get off the bus.
Oh, my gosh.
They're darting everywhere. Yeah.
They are.
They're ready to get out.
That's the worst nightmare that I have is hitting an adult, number one, but a kid even worse.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Just be wary of that and definitely stop. I mean, it's the same way I was driving over here on Hamden, and there was an ambulance coming down the street, and half the people aren't pulling over for the ambulance. It's like when you see emergency personnel coming down the road, you know, go to the right. That's the law. You go over to the right-hand side, let that vehicle go by, and then give them room. Don't get right up behind them and sort of follow them through.
Follow them so you can get faster. Yeah.
I see that, too, and that's not what the law says. You have to give them a wide berth.
Right. Another story that came up, I believe this was last week in Arvada. There was a lady sitting at a kind of a patio bar type deal. And
probably a dog bar.
Yeah, a dog bar. Yeah.
There are some of those around town.
Yeah, I'm telling you, they're everywhere. And unfortunately,
I didn't know dogs drank that much, but that's another story.
And unfortunately, a lady, the way I understand the story, she had a foster dog. I guess she was taking care of the dog for somebody else. But this other lady leaned over to pet the dog, and the dog reached up and just bit half her face. And so the ladies had to have, I think, one surgery and maybe a few more. The lady that had the dog kind of bolted out of the place, but then later the next day, I believe it was, went back to the police. So I wanted to bring up the dog issue because, boy, you look around at every Starbucks, I mean, coffee shops, to different downtown, I mean, everywhere. They, you know,
pet
most
shops,
businesses.
Petco.
Yeah, Petco, Bass Pro, Cabela's, all these different things. People take their dog. And so let's face this a couple ways. Let's talk about, you know, your responsibility as a dog owner and what you open yourself up for if you take your pet with you.
Yeah, so the first thing is relating to being a dog owner. Colorado has two laws, common law, which is basically negligence. You will be responsible for your dog biting someone if you know that the dog has bitten someone before and you know that they have a dangerous propensity to bite. And so where we run into this a lot is in premises liability cases. And basically, the premises liability statute says that you can't have a dangerous condition on your premises and not protect someone that you've invited there. So all of these businesses, when they, and there are a number of businesses out there that cater to having dogs on their premises. I think that there's some real danger for those businesses in the sense that they've got to be reasonable in their efforts to make sure that these dogs on the premises don't create that dangerous condition. And so the example that you have with the gal with the foster dog on the patio, you know, that owner of that dog is responsible. Number one, if they're if the fact that the dangerous propensity of the dog is unknown, so the dog has not bitten anyone before, they're still going to be responsible for the medical expenses for the person that's been bitten. Okay. They also may get criminally charged in that particular municipality for the dog bite as well, depending upon whether there's negligence that can be proven, and criminal activity. All right, so from the standpoint of you having a dog and the dog bites someone, you know, even if you didn't have knowledge that that dog had bitten someone before, if they bite someone, you probably are going to have to pay for the medical expenses of the human being that it was bit, and if it gets into a fight with another dog.
Yep.
Because we've had those sorts of cases too, where dogs get into fights and the victor sometimes has to pay for the dog's injuries that it bit.
And it can both of these can happen in a split second. I mean,
it can.
I saw this video in the news, and I mean, lady was sitting there, the dog looked calm, and all of a sudden lunged.
Yeah. You know? And I mean, they're still animals, and we still have to be really careful. And we probably could do a whole show on just talking about how to safely come near animals like and not put them in a situation where they react. Because I'm guessing, I haven't seen the video, but I'm guessing the woman was down there face to face with the animal. The animal doesn't know who this person is, probably got a little too close.
Right.
And there's going to be people out there to say, well, what do you expect the dog to do? You know, that it's going to happen.
Right.
Well, that's the issue, right? Is the unknown with regard to how this animal is going to react in public. And so that's where these entities that allow dogs to be on their premises, I think, have some liability. We've filed suit against some of these entities where there's been dogs that have bitten people on the premises. And there's a lot of advocates out there for dogs.
Sure.
And I have two, and I'm certainly one of them. At the same time, they're still animals. And so when you get into a confrontation between an animal and a human being, in my mind, the human being always comes out ahead.
Absolutely.
Now, there are certainly obligations for the person that's attempting to have contact with the animal to sort of invite that contact. If they're inviting it, they may have some responsibility as well. So there's some balance there relating
to it. So one tip, and I mean, like I say, I'm just thinking about this as we're talking about, but one tip may be always ask permission.
Mm-hmm.
May I pet your dog?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
And I'm bad about that. Dude, I see a dog, I'm petting it. You know,
right.
I mean, I love dogs.
Right.
And I mean, if a dog walks by, man, I'm going to reach out.
Yep.
But this is making me think now.
Absolutely. You always ask because you never know. Like, We've got a dog, big golden doodle, great dog, great around people, horrible around other dogs. Mm. I mean, especially when he's on a leash. So people will ask, can we pet your dog? And if they have a dog with them, I don't want the dog to be too close. And we've done some things to get him better. We've taken him to off-leash areas and tried to have him socialize with other dogs, and he's getting better. But as a puppy, he just has a really aggressive hello, you know? And he's a big dog, and so other dogs then react to sort of him coming over them, and they get snippy. And so that's where... So, yeah, absolutely. Asking permission, the first thing. Obviously, if you see a dog with a muzzle on them, you've got the people are putting you on notice. Hey, this dog has a propensity to be violent. And so it's a really interesting, I mean, in our society today, people want to take their dogs everywhere. And we could have a whole nother topic about, you know, service animals and emotional support dogs and that sort of thing, because there's really not a lot of regulations about that. And I think part of it is people, it's great because we have, I mean, it shows the sort of willingness of people to help out other animals, right? And the soft-heartedness that we have towards animals and want to be around it. But just really, legally, we have to be careful because dogs do bite.
Mm-hmm.
And they do cause real injury. Like this woman that is petting, you know, there's nothing that she's probably doing wrong other than maybe getting too close to the animal so that she can't react quickly when it does lunge at her.
So asking permission and then highly recommend... Don't get your face near the dog.
Right.
Stay upright. But, you know, pet the dog deal.
Correct.
You know, but don't.
Give them the opportunity to smell you so that there's no issue there, that you're not reacting fast so that they're not reacting like they think that you're going to be doing
and
harm to
kids,
them.
Little kids, if you've got kids with you, kids reach out, man, they'll pull the nape of the neck of a dog, right. Pull his tail, whatever. You never know.
So kids are a completely different thing, too. And smaller kids especially, you really have to be careful because I've had a number of cases where dogs people have been over for a birthday party. There's a bunch of family around. There's just a lot of activity. The dog freaks out about that. Mm-hmm. The dog, I've had dogs at Petco or PetSmart. I've had them at those individual retailers where the dog is going down the aisle and a kid comes around the aisle quick and scares the dog. The dog reacts and bites. And these dogs, especially some of the bigger ones, I mean, with a 3 or 4 year old kid, yeah, can really do some damage.
Damage, yeah.
Significant damage. And so then you you see on social media, the people are like, well, you should control your kid. Well, that's really the issue is where do we strike that balance? And when a dog, if you have any inkling that the dog will react, you just don't take them into those places because mm-hmm. you're going to run into children, you're going to run into adults like yourself that have a favorable experience with dogs,
right.
That are going to have some interaction. And so you just got to be careful. And then there's businesses that allow the animals on their premises. They have to be ready to be sued. Mm-hmm. Because that's part of the game. You're gonna, if you have enough interactions with between dogs and humans, it's gonna happen.
Yep.
And they have to make a decision as a business model. Does the liability offset the amount of financial gain we get by people coming into the store?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so like Cabela's for a while, I think was asking you to kennel your dogs or keep the dogs
right.
somewhere else, or they would work through that issue, which I think is a more responsible way of handling it,
mm-hmm.
especially where you get some of these high-strung hunting dogs. That,
oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you just don't know. And as much as I don't think the English setter that I have would do anything, I mean, I don't know. She gets pretty riled up and gets pretty mouthy with the other dog that we have, so there's certainly a possibility. And I wouldn't take her into that environment because unless she's been in it a lot.
Put yourself, I mean,
right.
That 15 minutes of the dog being in the store with you,
right.
There's a whole lot more that can go wrong than right.
There is. There's absolutely the case. And so that's probably the best opportunity unless you have a muzzle on them or you're certain that they can't cause injury to anybody. But in that scenario with I have seen other places, you know, there are dog bars around, and we kind of are making fun of them. But at the same time, that's their model. That's their business model, where they have people show up with their dogs.
Right.
And in those environments, you've got to be expecting that there's going to be some bloodshed at some point.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And you have to make the decision whether or not you frequent those places or whether or not how you handle the interactions with the dogs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Again, it's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch. Kevin's number, 303-806-8886, Flesch and Beck Law. You can check out his website at fleschlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H, lawfirm.com. But again, we thought this would be a great topic because, Colorado is a huge dog state. And just, you got to watch putting yourself in a bad position there and keeping your family safe and others safe as well as you shop and you're out and about at different facilities and restaurants and places like that. So we're going to take our short break, and we'll be back with more with Kevin Flesch.
Without changing your budget, own your home faster. Take AIM, 720-895-0500. Many of our clients have learned to pay less interest to the bank, not change their spending habits, and own their home faster. Affordable Interest Mortgage has a possible solution. 720-895-0500. Does your current loan allow you to access your equity without refinancing for another loan at higher rates? Does your current loan allow your equity to make your mortgage payment without late fees or dinging your credit? At AIM, we have a loan that allows you those freedoms, all for 30 years. This could be the last loan you need. Pay off your home faster, pay less interest to the bank, access your equity when you need it, skip payments. Call AIM for details, 720-895-0500. If you're tired of paying all that interest up front on a traditional 30-year fixed, call 720-895-0500 and let us save you thousands. Home of the Asset Manager, locally owned and operated, where it is all about you. 720-895-0500. Regulated by DOR, NMLS 298191, Equal Credit Lender.
Ladies, I know you're tired of walking into the local gun store and seeing the same old thing. So let me tell you about Rampart Firearms. Just a quarter mile up Highway 67 off of Santa Fe and Sedalia, you will find a great selection of guns, ammo, tactical, and personal defense weapons. And if you or your spouse love to hunt, Rampart Firearms is a great stop for all of your hunting needs. Shotguns, rifles, pistols, anything from predator hunting to your next big game trip. Head to Rampart Firearms at the foot of the Rockies. Open 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. And you will only pay a 4% tax on your purchase. RampartFirearms.com, 720-468-0050. That's 720-468-0050.
Rush to Reason with John Rush. Weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome back to Haystack Help Radio. It is the Legal Hour. Kevin Flesch is with us in studio. His number, once again, I want to give it to you, 303-806-8886. Put that number in your phone. You never know when you may need it. We hope you don't, but I tell you, I always like having it right at my fingertips. Just sometimes have questions for Kevin, and he'll be glad to help you and answer any questions he can for you. So, Kevin, I'll talk a little bit about the personal injury side of things, and a lot of misconceptions out there about, you know, car accidents, how people get paid for their injuries, and certainly nothing wrong with advertising. I mean, in a form, where, I mean, I like to look at our show as educational, but I guess, you know, no doubt it's advertising,
right.
But we try to be educational and just help people with different things. But, you know, TV's full of your TV ads, and, man, every person I see gets well over $1 million. So every case must get $1 million.
Yeah, that's what the right now that's what I see the most of,
right,
relating to the TV advertising that is out there. And there's a certain segment of the lawyer folks that advertise on TV, and that genre of advertising must work, obviously, because they continue to do it. You can't turn on a show just about any time of the day now, mm-hmm, and not see one firm or another advertising that they've gotten this big verdict or big settlement for the particular clients. And it is interesting because you really have to look at the ads, because they always have some disclaimer at the bottom.
Oh, yeah, there's about 10 lines of such small print, you can't see one word of it. Yeah.
And it really affects, I think, everyone's perception of what the value of their case is and in a car accident, and the fact that I get calls on a regular basis that a person has a car accident and they immediately think because they've had that accident that their case is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And unfortunately, that's just not the case. Those cases that have that sort of value, there's a reason why that value is there. And generally speaking, you know, where you have the people that are actually the victims of the car accident in those car accident cases, a lot of times where they've gotten $1 million or more, you don't see them standing up. You don't see them moving around, probably because it's very difficult for them to do that at that point. And they've had significant injuries to significant parts of their bodies. And so people have to remember that when you see those sorts of values of cases, there's several things that have gone on with regard to the case that have caused that value to happen. Number one, the liability in the case has to be almost certain that the other party is at fault for all of the liability. The other thing that must happen regarding those sorts of situations is that there has to be significant injury, and that significant injury has caused significant medical expenses. Because you don't get $1 million case when you have $5,000 in medical expenses. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. The only time that would happen is if, for example, you have a significant injury where you lose your sight or your hearing or the use of your hands, and you can prove that there's a significant loss of income with the loss of those particular areas of your body. If you're a professional pianist and you have a car accident and you lose one of your hands, you know, and you can prove that you had made several hundred thousand dollars a year over the course of 10 years and you won't be, and your profession would have allowed you for another 10 or 20 years of experience, and you won't have the ability to do that, and that causes you significant injury, then the case has real value like that. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you need is that you need to have the individual who's hit you have significant assets or significant insurance proceeds that you can get those sort of awards actually paid. And so real.
It's hard to pick who you have an accident with.
You can't. I mean, yeah. That's exactly right. Now there are certain cases in which you know that there are large limits, and you'll see advertising relating to those. The semi-truck accidents, the accidents with commercial vehicles, all of those sorts of scenarios, generally speaking, have large limits because that commercial entity wants to make sure that they're protected because their company has a lot of assets,
right.
And they want to get those things taken care of, and they want to limit their exposure, so they have a large insurance limit. So those sorts of cases are where you end up with those sorts of settlements where the limits may be $1 million or $2 million or $5 million or $10 million. You just don't know in the course of a car accident. The other time that you see it is when you have somebody that has a lot of assets and they have umbrella policies, and so they have the ability to pay out those sorts of things. But again, the insurance company doesn't just say, oh, you had a car accident, we're sorry about that, here's our policy limit of $1 million. I mean, because they're always critical of what exactly is going on with regard to the accident and how those injuries have been taken care of. Right. So they don't just stroke you a check for those amounts of money just because you got into a car accident with a person that has a high net worth. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so many times the advertising is misleading to the public because they think, then I get calls, well, I had an accident. I feel really badly about it. It really has upset me. So now the insurance company needs to pay all of the money that they have. Well, the trouble is if you have a person that is in either uninsured, where they have no limits and they have no assets, you know, your case has very little value. I've got a case right now that we're going to go to a damages hearing because the person has defaulted on our lawsuit, and we're going to be able to get a judgment for probably $1 million because I have a client that's been very badly injured, but I'm never going to collect that amount. So we could run a commercial today and say, hey, I got this person a judgment for $1 million, but what you can collect is another thing. And that's really where we add value, is trying to figure those things out. And so when you see those things, those are the things that people need to think about in the way of being able to get money back from a person that's caused them injury, because it'll all depend on what that other person has in the way of assets or insurance. And that drives a lot of what your upside is with regard to a car accident.
Right. And I told someone the other day, I said, you know, look at your policy and just figure out if the person you had the accident with, and again, it's their fault, and they had $25,000, how well would you be protected with your own policy? You know? Oh. And, I mean, that's the way you kind of got to look at it. You better protect yourself.
Absolutely, because state law is the minimums is $25,000 bodily injury coverage per person. And there's a lot of people out there that are driving with those minimum limits. And those minimum limits, I had a case last week. Client got T-boned in an intersection in Denver. Significant damage to the vehicles. She got the brunt of the impact because she was in the passenger side. She got taken by ambulance. She had a concussion. She was throwing up in the hospital, so they were worried about a head injury. So she had a CT scan, some MRIs, just the basic things in the emergency room. That emergency room bill probably will be $25,000 to $30,000. This is before she's gotten any other treatment. If that person that hit her, that insurance company will tender those $25,000 limits really quickly. But that doesn't really help her any, because she's going to have another year's worth of treatment. So in her case, we were really concerned about what do you have for underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage. And that's really important when looking at, you know, you and I aren't going to get into a car accident today, hopefully.
Sure.
But the thing that we can do to make sure that we protect ourselves is making sure that we know what our limits are relating to those underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage limits, and get as much as you can afford.
Right.
Relatively inexpensive coverage, so that when you get hit by that person that you didn't choose, that commercial driver is one thing, but most of us are going to get hit by someone that either has no insurance or very little limits.
Right.
And if you're significantly injured, then you're taking on all that risk yourself, because the other people, they'll either file bankruptcy or they'll have very little in the way of assets, and you're sitting there, you're going to have to handle your own losses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really sad to say.
Sure.
But in the context of educating people about it, and not just trying to say, hey, we're a law firm that will get you everything that we can. Well, it doesn't always happen that way. We'll get you whatever we can. But sometimes it's not really going to make you whole.
Yeah, for sure. So, again, when we go to look at what bills value in the case, you look at the liability, the medical expenses, I guess everybody always thinks pain and suffering, but yeah. I mean, is there a percentage of that usually in a case? Is that 10%, 20% of a case, or it's just hard? Every case is different.
Well, so pain and suffering is really difficult because when you have sort of the analysis of the case, the things that the jurors key on and are easy for them to figure out what value is the economic damages. Economic damages are those things that I can show them a receipt for something that's been paid. Mm-hmm. Medical expenses, you know, car damage, lost wages. Those are all things that we can harvest that evidence and show them on paper that this really happened.
Right.
Then the issue is, how do you prove to them emotionally what is pain and suffering worth? Because it's a little bit different for everybody. And there's certainly a whole segment of the population out there that the insurance company talks to on a regular basis to say that pain and suffering should be as low as possible. You know what I mean? I mean, and then we're out in the West. We're kind of a can-do sort of society, mm-hmm. and sort of, you know, you get into an accident and there's a certain segment of the population that will say to themselves, listen, you get in an accident, yeah, there's some stuff, but, you know, kind of brush yourself off, get up, and start moving forward again.
Right.
And so that pain and suffering in their mind is fairly minimal because they've never actually been into a car accident where they've been significantly injured, or they've never had a situation in their life where they really are victims of a circumstance, mm-hmm. and they just haven't experienced that, so they don't understand when people are saying they've really been injured. They see them as sort of being more whiny and more sort of handout, you need to pay me something, when people have really been hurt,
sure.
and they really should be compensated. But that's not how some jurors look at it. And so what that does is that causes the value of those pain and suffering arguments to be reduced. But there's still some aspect of a case relating to pain and suffering. So that's always the thing that you're trying to create a value for. And the way we do that is by getting your treatment providers to say, no, this person was really hurt. I could tell objectively when they would come into the doctor's office for their visits that there was real trauma that has happened, and that trauma has caused real injury. And so treatment providers are good. Other people in your life that see you on your daily basis, how your life has changed is really good. You know, that's where we've talked about social media in the past, where you don't want to be out dancing at a wedding when
water skiing or
right.
yeah. snow skiing.
Yep, doing other things that will affect you, because those are the sorts of things that the other side will say, oh, your pain and suffering isn't so bad because you're able to do all of these other activities. So, lately, some of the things that defense lawyers have been asking my clients in depositions are, well, what vacations have you had in the last 2 years after this car accident? Because they equate that then in the jury that if this person can go on a vacation, they can't be that hurt. You know, that sort of argument. Of course, you can still go on vacations and still have personal injuries. But those are the sorts of tactics that they take so that they minimize those values relating to personal injury. So what we normally see is what we like to have in the way of a calculation relating to the personal injuries is at least the medicals, maybe twice the medicals in the way of pain and suffering is what we'd like to see. And it all depends on how long you've had medical treatment and how that medical treatment has affected you over time.
Right. It's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch. Again, Kevin's number, 303-806-8886. When we come back, you talked about deposition. I want to talk about that a minute and how that process works and how you work with a client, because you're always there, I assume,
yes.
when they do a deposition.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, just want to let you know, and insurance companies, when they call you and it's not been your fault, they may sound friendly, but they're not your friend. Okay.
Right.
They are not looking out, what can we do for this person to make them whole again? We'll be right back.
What could you do with an extra $500, $1,000, or even $1,500 per month? How would that change things for you? Would you buy a new car, pay off bills, or just feel a bit more secure about your retirement? What if I told you there's a way to make your dreams a reality? I'm talking about trading and investing in the market. Now, before you say, oh, that's not for me, just hear me out. I want to invite you to a half-day trading course so you can check this out. I promise you, you'll go away smarter than when you came in. We here at Online Trading Academy sponsor this, and we'll even send you home with a free home study video guide. Your money's doing nothing for you in a CD or mutual fund. Learn how to profit when the market's up or down. Call us now while seats are still available at 303-325-2776. Use offer code RADIO50. 303-325-2776. That's 303-325-2776.
This is Steve Hurley with Affordable Interest Mortgage. I'm reaching out to you to help answer questions regarding the value of a reverse mortgage. You've heard both sides. I'm dedicated to helping seniors. The reason, like you, I am a senior and a veteran. Our wants and needs are different when compared to years past. Give me a call at 720-895-0500. Remember, take aim. Call me, Steve Hurley, at 720-895-0500. NMLS number 243200. Regulated by DORA, an equal opportunity lender.
Hi, this is Scott Watley. Now, many times you hear your radio host like me say something like, "Let me tell you about my friends at," then we'll talk about a sponsor that we truly believe in and endorse. Well, in this case, let me tell you about a company that really is part of my family, Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center. For over 13 years, we have trusted our furry family members to this wonderful staff. At Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center, they believe that all pets deserve to have a good life, and their goal is to help you keep your pets happy and healthy throughout their life by providing complete pet care services every day, all at one location. We love the Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center boarding lodge, and your pet will too. Your pet will receive one-on-one care and attention throughout their stay. Open 7 days a week for your convenience. Check them out. Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center, located at 8681 Lincoln Avenue in Lone Tree. 303-708-8050. 303-708-8050. Or check them out online at lonetreevet.com.
Denver's Afternoon Rush. Rush to Reason is coming up at 3. Now, back to Haystack Help Radio.
Welcome back to Haystack Help Radio. It's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch, fleschlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H, lawfirm.com, Flesch and Beck Law. So, Kevin, you mentioned the deposition. And has that process, I mean, not necessarily the process, but like I say, questions, types of questions they get have probably evolved over the years now with just the changes of, like you say, social media in our world today.
Yes. So depositions are a real important part of, so what happens in a case, we, client comes to us, they get through all of their treatment, they get back to as close to 100% as possible. We then get all of the damages and everything put together. We make a demand to the insurance company. If the insurance company and I can't come up with a reasonable number to settle the case for, then I go forward and I file a lawsuit. In the midst of that lawsuit, we have to give certain disclosures and we have to answer interrogatories and production of documents and respond to admissions.
And do you get those questions beforehand?
Yeah, so the interrogatories and things are written questions beforehand. But normally what happens is the way the defense now sets it up is we file the case, we have what's called a case management conference, we complete a case management order, which basically gives an explanation of when the deadlines are for discovery. The defense will then go through and do their homework in the sense that they send you questions to answer. And you respond to them in writing. Mm-hmm. And then you provide them additional documents and everything to really show what your case is worth and how you're going to prove it at trial. Most defense lawyers then will want to take your deposition. And in that deposition, the purpose of that deposition from the defense's perspective is they want to get to see you in action. They want to see how you're going to respond to questioning, how you're going to respond to sort of critical thought relating to the claim, how exactly, what things anger you potentially, what things you're unwilling to talk about, all of those things. And they want to put pressure on you so that you say, "I don't want to go through that ever again," right?
Right.
Every lawyer has a little bit different tact about how exactly to do that. Some lawyers are just sort of give me the facts, ma'am, sort of people, and they've got a litany of questions that they want to talk about, and they want to get a sense of what the responses are going to be so that they can then provide a report to an insurance company, an insurance adjuster, to tell them what they think about you as a witness and how you're going to react with the jury, because that's a big thing. It's kind of like a long-term job interview. to some degree, because they want to get a sense of how you're going to be at trial, and that does affect the value of the case.
Right.
Sometimes I have clients that perform very well in depositions, very personable, have no trouble sort of opening up their life to the person, and it's clear to the defense lawyer when they get done, this witness is not one that I want to present to a jury because they're going to be really good for their case. And those cases, generally speaking, settle. The cases that don't are the individuals who are very difficult in a deposition, are combative, come across as really trying to hide things, are easily manipulated into a situation where a juror is just not going to like them. Mm-hmm. And those cases are more difficult to get the insurance company to give more money than they should because they think, well, this is going to be a good opportunity for us. And what we think the value then of the case is less because the person is not going to perform as well in front of six people. And so in prepping folks for their depositions, what I like to do is I like to spend some time with them explaining the process that, because it's a little unusual. I mean, you and I, in on the radio, you know, we try not to talk over each other. We try to listen to the question that's presented and then respond to the question verbally so that our listeners can hear that. It's the same thing in a deposition. But many times people think it's sort of a conversation where you can interrupt and you can talk over people and do all of those things that are really not very beneficial, not only in a deposition but in a jury situation, because it just doesn't look like you have very good manners and those sorts of things. And, you know, people, when you get into a jury trial, first of all, jurors don't want to be there. They're not interested in doing this, generally speaking. The ones that are, I have a little concern about, because I'm like, why don't you have better things to do? Not that jury trials aren't important, but, you know, taking time out of your life to make decisions about someone else's problems, most people don't want to do that. So at any rate, so when you get into depositions, the thing that I try to explain to them is I'm going to be there, first of all, and I will be able to help you sort of umpire the way things go. But the bottom line is that you have to answer just about every question that's presented to you, even if it's uncomfortable. And those particular areas of that become uncomfortable is if people have criminal histories that they have to talk about,
gotcha.
Right? Because those sorts of things are fair game in a deposition, because even in a civil case, you get to ask about their criminal convictions if it affects their ability to be truthful. And so generally the law says that if you have any sort of criminal conviction within 5 years relating to misdemeanors, then they get to ask you about them. And any felony convictions within 10 years. And the idea is that the jurors want to know about that because that may affect their ability to determine whether or not you're credible or not. All right. So those sorts of questions sometimes are uncomfortable. If you've brought what's called a loss of consortium claim with your spouse, so your spouse says, because of this car accident, my life has been affected because my husband or wife have been affected by this injury.
They had to take care of them.
Yep, had to take care of them, right. or their sexual relations are different, or other sorts of spousal maintenance is different. Once you raise that claim, then opposing counsel gets to ask about your sex life. And that's really uncomfortable. And those sorts of questions would seem to be completely out of bounds, but the law relating to loss of consortium allows them to
talk
about it.
You open the door.
You do. and some people are really uncomfortable with it, and some people are not. And the ones that I have the conversation early on when we're actually filing the case, and I talk with spouses about this and say, listen, you have a claim to the other spouse. And your claim is what's called loss of consortium. And it's what is included in this claim if we want to bring it. But these are the downsides with these sorts of claims. And these are the things that we need to prove. And these are the things we want to stay away from if we can. But you get to be asked about these things in the deposition. And so those sorts of questions early on in the litigation process need to be kind of worked out. Mm-hmm. And if you're comfortable with it, fine. If you're not, then you don't stay away from it. And jurors don't want to hear about that,
right.
You know. So depositions, the other things that happen are prior injuries. Those are the things that defense really want to get into, because they want to say then, they want to point to those things in trial to say, well,
it wasn't. Or they say, hey, now, you were hurt here, but 30% instead of 100%.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And there's different legal theories. There's a thin skull rule, which basically we were just talking earlier about the fact that you can't make a decision as to who's going to hit you in the way of their mm-hmm. limits and other things. The same thing can be said with a person that does cause an injury. They don't get to choose the fact that you've had a significant injury to your back in the past, and that does affect how this accident has affected those injuries, because they still have to pay for those sorts of things. So it goes both ways. But all of those things are fair game in a deposition. The other thing that people just don't realize is the time it takes for you to be deposed. I mean, I had a deposition yesterday that took 20 minutes, but that's happened once in 10 years. Wow. Normally, depositions are somewhere between a half day and a full day. So you're talking 4 to 8 hours of time that you're having to tell about your life and talk about minute details of what happened in an accident, and things are scrutinized. I'll give you an example. Last week, we had a deposition where a person was injured in a car accident, and their medical records had three or four different versions that he had told medical providers about what happened relating to his injuries. Well, I think the scriveners, the people that wrote down his history, and a couple of them got it wrong. But it's now on paper, and it's now with a medical provider. And so he gets asked three or four different ways about, well, look at this medical record. They're saying that this accident that you told them about happened this way. Why do you think they would have gotten this information? Or where would they have gotten it from? Mm-hmm. And you're immediately put on the defensive, like he did something wrong. And that's the sort of thing that defense lawyers will do to try to make it difficult for a person to go forward. And jurors look at credibility of, well, were they lying to their medical providers? I mean, half the time, medical providers just get it wrong.
Sure.
And then you have to have an education experience with the jurors about why that's wrong. But that's the sort of thing that happened in depositions, and that's why the deposition preparation for those things are so important.
Right. Can they only ask the questions that they have submitted to you, or are they free to ask?
They're free to ask almost anything. And I can object. The way the deposition works is that you'll ask a question. I think it's objectionable for whatever reason, some legal basis that I raise.
And let me ask you, I assume the judge is not in there. Who is the other parties in it? You got the defense in their deal. Who's overseeing that? Anybody else, or just attorneys?
Just the attorneys.
Okay.
So the defense lawyers.
So you can go, man, you can't ask that.
You can.
Yeah.
You can certainly.
We don't have to answer it.
Well, right. But you've got to certify the question then. So then at that point, you have to explain to the other side, listen, we're not going to ask, because everything's being taken down by a court reporter. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is recorded. So you'll want to make a record for a judge later to make a decision about. So, for example, they may ask you about, you had a sexual assault allegation 25 years ago that was dismissed. And somehow they think that it's related to a car accident that happened last year. I don't know how it would be related. So you'll object. And generally speaking, that's a really personal thing for the person to talk about. And it's so remote in time. So I may object, foundation. Why is that important? Relevance. And the lawyer may respond, if they want to be difficult and curt about it, they say, well, I want to ask the question. Okay, well, I don't think it's related in any way. There was no conviction. It's a completely outrageous thing that you're now bringing up relating to a car accident 25 years later. Mm-hmm. We're not going to answer that question.
Right.
We'll then certify it. And if it's a really big deal that they think is important for that deposition, we can call the court and see if they'll give us a ruling. Normally the judge isn't available, so you've made the record, and then you have a whole motions practice about whether or not that deposition gets to be reopened, and they get to ask questions about that particular area of inquiry. And it all depends on what it is that we're dealing with, that whether it's related enough, and whether or not there just aren't that many questions that the person I instruct not to answer. Generally speaking, you answer the question, then you fight about it later. Because sure. Sometimes the answer is, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Well,
if they don't remember, then it's not a big deal, because it's not any evidence that's really important.
Right.
But it can get pretty contentious. I had a really contentious deposition 2 weeks ago in a case where we had to get the court on the phone to deal with it. And luckily the judge was available. He made a ruling on what it was that was going on. And then we moved on with the deposition once we got the ruling.
And I'm sure sometimes there's some coaching on your part, because you get that person that, is asked a very simple question and they want to spew for 5 minutes. And I don't know why I just remember this, but you remember back when O.J. Simpson was before that parole board?
Yes.
Every answer was 5 to 10 minutes, it seemed like.
Yes.
And it's like, dude, just answer the question and shut up.
Right. And that's one of the things that we also talk about with the client beforehand, that this deposition is not your totality of time that you have to tell your story, because you'll be able to get that. When we actually go to jury trial, I'll be asking you open-ended questions so that you can go into that dialogue. What sometimes where I get a client that is very wordy in the sense that they want that, mm-hmm. I try to suggest to them to play a game to see if you can minimize the amount of words that you give them in the way of a response, because generally speaking, that's better for you, and it doesn't open other doors. I mean, lawyers are smart people, so there's a lot of times where they'll ask a question, you'll go off on a tangent, and that'll lead to a whole new group of questions.
And sometimes places you don't want to go.
Right, yeah. That they weren't even going to ask you about, and things you really hadn't needed to disclose, that now that you've talked about it, now they're interested in. Mm-hmm. And that causes problems for some folks. And so I really work with them to try to keep them away from those sorts of things and make sure that they understand it's really just an exercise for the defense to get to know who you are and to get the minority of the involvement in what took place and sort of the facts and circumstances. You don't have to give them the biblical explanation about something. Just keep it as concise as possible.
Absolutely. It's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch. Once again, Kevin's number, 303-806-8886, fleschlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H, lawfirm.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about a few points here on, ways you can hurt your case and things like that. We'll just give you a few tips there. And then we'll try to end up today with this. Don't try to handle your own case. I mean, there's a lot involved. There's a reason why you're an attorney. You have to go to school for that, Kevin. There's a lot to know. We'll be right back.
Fight rising auto insurance premiums by calling Group Insurance Analysts. Paul Lenigro, owner of GIA, has seen a significant spike in auto insurance premiums over the past few years due to the large number of expensive hailstorms in Colorado. You remember last summer when that record-breaking hailstorm caused $1.4 billion in damages? Not just to homes and roofs, but plenty of vehicles took the hit too. And insurance companies are passing the cost right along to you. Now more than ever, you need an insurance advocate who will shop the entire market, hunting for the right coverage at the best price. Paul and his team of analysts will compare the plans of many different insurance companies at no cost to you. Call Group Insurance Analysts today and reevaluate your auto insurance before premiums continue to rise. 303-423-0162.
Hi, this is Scott Watley. Let me tell you what I love about Stack Optical. They are truly one of the last optician-owned, family-owned optical stores. At Stack Optical, you can be confident you'll receive personal attention. For over 50 years, Alan Stack has shown he really cares about making his customers happy. Stack Optical also has a beautiful new location at 2233 South Monaco Parkway in Denver. Free and easy, up-close parking. Stack Optical has an on-site eyeglass production lab. Whether you need office eyewear or a new set of shooting or golf glasses, Stack Optical has the solution with the Stack Sport Pack. Give them a call today and ask for their $69 eye exam, 303-321-1578. That's 303-321-1578. Your eyes and vision are one of the most important things in life. I'm confident at Stack Optical, you'll see the difference. That's 303-321-1578, stackoptical.com.
Rush to Reason with John Rush, weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome back to the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch. My name is Scott Watley, and we appreciate you being with us. And, I'm telling you, there's been some great points today. And if you've missed any part of this show, go to our website, haystackhelpradio.com, and catch the first part of this. If you're a dog owner especially, we covered some very, very important tips there with handling your dogs and the responsibilities out in public with your pets. So be sure and catch that. So, Kevin, let's talk about some of the things here, with ways people can hurt their case.
Yeah, so So the interesting thing about Colorado, and I'm seeing less and less in this as the population gets old or younger in Denver. In 2003, Colorado, the law relating to PIP, the No Fault Act, sunsetted, and we're now a tort state. And so what that means is that you, as a victim of a car accident, have to take care of your accident injuries and all of the things relating to it, and then you make a demand to the insurance company or to the at-fault party for your injuries. And the reason that that is important in our discussion today is because in the past, the insurance company would pay things as you went. The at-fault parties would pay things, or your insurance would pay things through the no-fault provisions of your insurance company. Right. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. It happens a little bit with regard to MedPay, but generally speaking, it doesn't the way it used to. And so people got conditioned for 30 years to handle their cases a certain way, and that way changed about 15 years ago. And the reason that it's important to get a lawyer involved early on in your case is because you can do things that will hurt you when you make that demand. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. I've got a client that we're actually in the midst of litigation right now. He had a horrific car accident, was taken by ambulance to the hospital, had significant amounts of medical work done at the ER, and he seemed to be doing pretty well. Young kid, thought that his back injuries were going to just subside over time, and so he gave himself about a month or two of no medical treatment whatsoever because he thought it would just go away. Well, it didn't. I mean, and now we see his MRI reports, and he had bulging discs. He had real significant problems with his case and with his injuries early on. But he's now got this gap of 60 days. And that gap then gives the insurance company the opportunity to say, well, you must not have been that hurt because you didn't treat for a long period of time. And then when he did treat, he treated sort of sporadically, and then there were additional gaps in treatment. And so those are the sorts of things that people hurt themselves with when they don't have someone like myself saying, hey, how are things going?
Right.
Things going well? And you went to the ER and you had a bunch of treatment and they were really concerned about you. You don't just miraculously get better. Mm-hmm. And so that's where people hurt themselves in the sense of not getting the treatment they need right away. The other thing that people do is they don't follow their doctor's orders. Right. and I understand people get busy and people really want to believe that their body will just heal themselves. But some of these injuries, most, don't happen that way. The medical profession is out there to help you with these things, and they're trained to help you. And it's not a home remedy sort of scenario. And so a lot of these sorts of cases, the people really hurt themselves by not getting the appropriate treatment that they need and not following the doctor's orders then when they do get it. I'll give you another example. I had a client that had a concussion, closed head injury, and had some real cognitive problems. He did a bunch of research online right after the accident, and he decided that what he needed was just to take a year off, basically, and see how his brain healed itself. And he got no medical treatment during that year. And he actually came to us about a week before the three-year limit of the statute of limitations was about to run. He had a significant injury in his case. But he had these huge gaps. And in fact, we were in his deposition about 3 weeks ago, and defense counsel talked about the 417-day gap that he had in treatment. And she continued to say that throughout the deposition. And there was an example. If he would have come in to me early on in his case with the cognitive issues that he was having, we would have suggested to him, hey, you need to get to a neurologist.
Right.
You need to get to someone that can really document what is going on with your head injury and really help you with that. And in his particular case, he also had a history of ADHD, which then gave the opposing counsel the opportunity to say, well, really, you didn't have a head injury from this car accident. You had these other problems. And so in the end, we're getting very little value for his case because he didn't get competent legal advice early on, and he didn't get the medical treatment that he needed early on to really establish the problems that he had.
Right.
And he's really frustrated at this point. But it comes down to the fact that we can only prove what we have for evidence. I can't create evidence after the fact.
Sure.
And so after an accident happens, after you've got an injury from whatever it is, if you don't create that evidence and you don't show that you're really injured, then a jury or an insurance company isn't going to believe you when you say you have these damages.
Right.
And that's where people fall down sometimes, yep. is because they, I mean, the internet's great. It really is helpful for giving you an idea of, hey, these are the issues I need to look out for. But it's really the phone call. We give free consultations. I mean, and we do that for a reason, because we can help people through the process. But you need to do it early on in your case,
yep.
so that you have an understanding of, oh, these are the things I need to look out for. Because a lot of times people don't even know the sort of landmines they're causing for themselves.
Because the battle you take on 2 weeks before the end of 3 years is immense.
Well, it is. And unfortunately, he didn't have any choice. We had to file the lawsuit. Otherwise, he'd get nothing. But when we move forward with the case and you've got these glaring problems that the insurance company is saying, we want to try this case because we want to see. Mm-hmm. We don't have that many cases where there's this huge gap and, you've got all this history. So we want to kind of test this out. They're willing to take it on because sure. the other problem in his particular case is the person that hit him had $25,000 of limits. So the insurance company looks at it and says, we have very little risk. You know, we get it wrong.
Yeah, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah, we'll pay $25,000. There you go. Thanks. And have a nice day. There's no downside for them. And if we had probably set up the case early on and gotten them treatment that he needed, that probably would have helped him anyway.
Yeah.
Then it would have been much easier to get those limits. But now we're not going to. And so those are the sorts of things that people do when they think they know how the process works, and they think they've gone on some websites and they've looked at things, and they say, I can save myself the contingency fee, the percentage of the lawyer's fees down the road. But what they really do is they don't end up getting anything because they completely mess it up.
Right. And we'll end with this. If you are in a current situation where maybe you are handling this yourself, we'll end with this. And you have a certain dollar amount on the table. We always talk about you adding value. So explain that scenario and how you handle it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we do is, so let's say you have handled it yourself and you've gotten to the point where you've got an offer from the insurance company, and you're just not sure whether or not that's a fair offer or not. That's certainly something we can talk our way through. The things that you will need so that I understand exactly what the value is, exactly what's been billed for the medical expenses relating to your treatment. I'll need to see those medical records and understand what exactly the treatment was and how it's affected you and whether or not you need any future treatment. We'll also talk about other losses that you may have had. And then we'll put together an idea of what we think the value of the case would be if we were resolving it for you. Mm-hmm. And then whatever the amount difference is. So if sometimes you'll get an offer. I'll have a person call me. I got $2,500 in medical expenses. I've got $500 in lost wages. They're offering me $7,000 to resolve the case. We then do our analysis and say, you know what? We probably can get you a few more $1,000, and we would take a percentage of that off of that few more $1,000. But at the same time, it may be less than that.
Right.
And so in that sort of scenario, economically, it doesn't make sense for us to move forward. I've also had the case where the person is offered $25,000 and their case is worth $300,000. And we've handled those. And so then we take the percentage on top of what they've already been offered
right.
as what our fee is, because that's the value that we've added. And it works out great for the client
sure.
and for ourselves. So those are the sorts of discussions we have in that free consultation to see if it makes sense for us to move forward.
Right. Great information, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Give Kevin a call, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, fleshlawfirm.com, Flesh and Beck Law. Thank you for being with us today on the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesh. Check out our website, haystackhelp.com, and our helpline is always there for you, 303-333-HELP, 303-333-4357. Hope you have a great rest of your day, and leave it right here on KLZ 560.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.